This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's beginning to seem like old times, and not in a good way. Relations between Moscow and Washington have become so chilly of late that some talk of a new Cold War. There's been angry language from both sides over a range of issues: nuclear missiles, strategic missile defense, arms control, human rights, the independence of Kosovo, and Iran's nuclear ambitions. The Kremlin has been accused of starting a cyber war against NATO ally Estonia, and Britain charges one former KGB officer with the murder of another former Soviet spy in London. In an effort to warm up relations, President Bush invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to visit his father's summer home in Kennebunkport, Maine. Today we'll look at the declining relationship between Russia and the United States. Later in the hour, sleep and why so many of us don't get enough of it. What's your excuse? Send us an email, talk@npr.org. But first, why relations with Russia seem to be as bad as they've been since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Lilia Shevtsova. She's senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we heard the Russian foreign minister and the secretary of state trading barbs. President Putin was talking today about a new arms race. Is this just rhetoric, or is things as bad as they sound?
Well, things are really bad. And I haven't remembered the relationship is so cold during the last 15 years. But still, it's not the Cold War, and due to several reasons. During the Cold War, there were two powers, superpowers, that were fighting each other desperately for their preponderance and for hegemony. And they were fighting each other to get their philosophy and ideology to get it dominant. Mm-hmm. It was the fight between Marxism, communism on the one side, and liberal democracy. So far, Russia rejected any claims to be a communist power. And now, so far, at least on the verbal level, Russia has endorsed liberal democracy in its constitution as the major standard and system of values. And there are some other reasons why Russia and United States cannot go for war. Asymmetry of resources. Russian military budget is $20 billion. And the Soviet Union spent on military needs one-third of its GDP. Russia now is spending only a little bit more than 2.7%. And besides, there is one very important and maybe ironic thing. Neil, you'll smile now. Russian political elite and Russian business are very much pro-West, and despite of the fact that our relations are so chilly. Hmm. And that's the irony, and that's the paradox. Because on the one hand, Russian political leaders, people in the Kremlin and around the Kremlin, they would like to be a kind of Roman Abramovich on the personal and corporative level. They want to be integrated into the West, to have their families in the West, to have their banking accounts in American and Western banks. And at the same time, they would like to close Russia for the Western impact. So they want to have it both ways, mm-hmm. to be pro-Western and to be anti-American in Russia.
Now, this range of issues that we mentioned earlier, and we'll get into them in more detail a bit later, but given this range of issues, Iran, Kosovo, weapons of various types, is this an accumulation of individual issues, or is there some underlying factor, underlying all of this that speaks to the hostility that we've seen of late?
I would say underlying factor is very powerful, and the underlying factor is we organize ourselves, I mean Russia and America, on a different basis. Still we have this, systemic, structural, existential difference. We built in Russia our system, first of all, on the premise of the state and monopoly of power. You, America, built your system on a different principle, on a different standard. So incompatibilities between us are structural. And at the same time, these incompatibilities, of course, influence all other values and common interests. And having these, incompatible principles that we follow, of course, this fact influences all other issues, all other foreign policy questions.
Let's get into some of the specifics. And joining us also here in Studio 3A is Daryl Kimball, Executive Director of the Arms Control Association, which is a think tank based here in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you on the program as well.
My pleasure.
And there is the dispute lately. Vladimir Putin says the United States is starting a new arms race by the installation of this, as it's described, a very modest ballistic missile defense system. It's yet to be installed, but there's talk of installing it with a radar in the Czech Republic and some missile silos in Poland. Is this a new arms race?
Well, not yet. And we're not, I would agree with Lilia, we're not in a new Cold War, but the plan to deploy 10 interceptors in Poland along with a specialized radar in the Czech Republic in the next 3 to 4 years by the Bush administration has roiled Russia. They are concerned that as their strategic nuclear arsenal shrinks and as the United States retains the capability to reconstitute a large part of its arsenal in the future, their strategic nuclear retaliatory capability could be compromised. Now, we're a long, long way from there, but they're concerned about that. They're also concerned about how they see this as a pattern, part of a pattern. NATO was expanded in the 90s. The United States is planning to work with Romania and Bulgaria to build military bases there. There's the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Russia sees the Western military infrastructure knocking at their door.
So a continuation of the old policy of containment and encroaching it.
Right. And so the missile defense proposal is kind of the icing on the cake, and it is something that does need to be resolved. I think we cannot simply wish Russia's concerns away, because they can do some things that are negative to global security and their own security.
Well, again, those overall issues, but this radar, this limited ballistic missile defense system, I think it was just the other day that the Russians test fired this new missile, the RS-24, which they said would be capable of overwhelming and defeating any possible ballistic missile shield that the United States could erect, and Secretary of State Rice laughingly said, "We completely agree. This isn't designed for that. This is designed to protect against missile launches from Iran or North Korea."
Well, I mean, from the U.S. perspective, we are no longer enemies, and Russia should have nothing to fear from the United States' very substantial nuclear and strategic military capabilities. But Russia sees it in another way, and it is not so much the intentions as the capabilities that they seem to be looking at. And what Russia sees, and I think there are some validity to this, is that the United States is saying that this missile defense system is designed to deal with a future North Korean or Iranian missile threat. That threat doesn't exist now. With respect to Iran, it's not going to exist for at least another decade. That's worrisome, but Russia's wondering, well, why is this being built on this fast schedule? The Bush administration wants to start pouring concrete within the next 2 years. They are suspicious, and perhaps they're using this as an excuse to bring up other issues, but they are troubled.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests again are Lilia Shevtsova of the Moscow Carnegie Center and Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association. And let's begin with Rolf. Rolf is with us from Woodridge, Illinois.
I would like to comment on why I think the relationships are at a low point. And my feeling is that it was the Bush administration's overzealous policy of embracing Putin in the early part of the Bush administration that set the stage for the situation that we're in now. Certainly the invasion of Iraq and our unilateral policies of invasion have added to that. But I think it's caused Putin and the Russian leaders to feel a lot more nervous about the intentions of the United States. And I think we should have taken a much more cautious approach towards Russia in the early years by encouraging them to develop their democracy. But I think the Bush administration's approach towards them set the stage for now a retrenchment of our relationship and foreign policy with them.
Lilia Shevtsova, we all remember the line about George Bush looking into Mr. Putin's soul.
Oh, right. Yes. Now he apparently will think twice about that. Maybe looking into Putin's soul, he'll find something else. But we'll see. They meet. They will meet on July the 1st, and it will be occasion for President Bush to look again into Mr. Putin's soul.
Let me ask you a question. These are both men who are at the twilight of their presidencies. As we know, there will be a new election in this country in 2008. Mr. Putin faces, he's not eligible to run. He can't run again.
No, he cannot.
And has made no effort thus far to, as many feared, change the Constitution, so he could. So he is on his way out as well.
That's true. So they both are lame duck.
And how does that affect the ongoing relationships?
Well, it affects in a direct way. They cannot change the trajectory in the relationship. And apparently, the both leaders, what they can do, they could do damage control, and they could simply prevent the relationship from sliding down even further.
Mm-hmm.
But hardly they can invent any initiative.
I wanted to ask you, Daryl Kimball, as they talk, are there going to be, is there possibility for, you know, important resolutions at this meeting coming up in July?
Well, I think there are possibilities. I mean, there are discussions underway on several of these military issues. First of all, one of the things the Bush administration did early on, as he is President Bush looked into his eyes, Putin's eyes, was to say that the two countries can reduce their strategic nuclear arsenals much lower. But Bush preferred to do this not through a treaty, as Reagan and Gorbachev and Bush's father did, but through a handshake agreement known as a Moscow Treaty. The Russians were not pleased with that. They wanted more certainty. And so one of the issues that has come up once again is whether the two sides should extend or allow the 1991 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty to expire. This was an older treaty. And if that expires, there will be less certainty about what each other is doing because it contains a lot of important verification provisions. So those talks right now are going on at the expert level. There is an opportunity to raise this up at the Kennebunkport meeting, and maybe some progress can be made.
In the few seconds before we go to a break, Lilia Shevtsova, getting back to Rolf's questions, were expectations too high in the beginning, and does that lead to the situation where we are now?
I don't think that there were high expectations at the beginning of the Bush-Putin tenure. It seems to me the problem was, and our listener rightly pointed it out, Bush tried to pursue towards Russia realpolitik without thinking, apparently, about the word D, and never apparently trying to persuade President Putin to follow his and Russia's commitments. Democracy commitments.
Rolf, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We'll talk more with Lilia Shevtsova and Daryl Kimball. I'm Neil Conan. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about sleep and why we don't get enough of it. You can email us the reason why you tell yourself you didn't have to get 8 hours last night, talk@npr.org. But right now, we're looking at the declining relationship between the U.S. and Russia and the prospects of what some call a new Cold War. Our guests are Lilia Shevtsova, senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center, and Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association. If you have questions about relations between the two countries or how bad it might get, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Here's an email from Mark in Buffalo, New York. Is this Russian behavior, natural gas, games, etc., a clever, quicker, self-identified way to nudge themselves back into a global leadership role? Lilia?
Well, I don't think that even the most aggressive part of the Russian leadership are not that pragmatic, and they don't understand that apparently Russia is not that powerful, even with all these energy resources,
mm-hmm.
that, well, it should pretend to be a global power again. But definitely Russia wants to be a regional superpower.
And that's perhaps behind the reason behind what everybody believes was Russia's role in that cyber war against Estonia.
Well, it's difficult to tell who is initiating these cyber attacks on Estonian websites because, well, cyber attacks became a powerful instrument that is being used by all political forces in Russia, but quite possibly that the government has started to be the initiator.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Dan. Dan's with us from Rochester, Minnesota.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am wondering what's the current status of the Russian military capabilities, technology, how they rank with the United States, and the overall size of their naval and land forces.
Daryl Kimball, the Russian armed forces were in precipitous decline for many years. Are they in a state of revival?
Well, I would say that they're not anywhere close to where the United States is with respect to conventional military forces, but Russia still has very sizable ground forces, a large navy by global standards, and of course they have the world's largest nuclear weapons arsenal. One of the issues that is aggravating U.S.-Russian relations right now is an issue related to the conventional forces of Russia and the former and NATO countries in Europe. There was a 1990 treaty that limited the former Warsaw Pact countries and the NATO countries' number of tanks and troops. It's one of the most important agreements that helped end the Cold War. There was an agreement in 1999 to revise it. Russia very much wants these revisions, but the NATO countries are not moving ahead with that adapted treaty because Russia has not pulled out troops as it pledged from Moldova and Georgia. And this is one of the things that Vladimir Putin has said Russia may not observe in a year if there's not a resolution.
That's so the CFE agreement, conventional forces in Europe.
Conventional forces in Europe. So the forces are not anywhere close to where the United States is in terms of numbers and capabilities, but with respect to European security, they are still a very significant factor.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you also a follow-up on a specific case, and that regards Kosovo. Russia has been a longtime ally of Serbia. The UN arbitrator, the Finnish leader, Antti Niinistö, I think is pronounced, I think I got that wrong, but close enough. But they've recommended basically that Kosovo get independence. This is going before the Security Council. Russia is, well, all but openly threatening a veto if that's the case.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, this is, it's not clear to me whether Russia is reflexively supporting its old Cold War ally Serbia here, whether it has legitimate concerns about the new plan that the West backs. But, you know, this is another example of the host of issues that have not been resolved between the two countries, and Russia seems to be, to me, flexing its muscles as a way of gaining attention and forcing the West to respond to Russia's longstanding concerns.
Does that make sense to you, Lilia?
Yes, definitely. I would agree with Daryl. And there is one more issue in this context. You know, Serbia, again, the new political leadership of Serbia, is playing with Russia, just like Milosevic had done, trying to use Russia in its own political gimmicks. And it seems to me it's up to the West and European community and the United States to find their own leverage, you know, with Serbian leadership and simply invite Serbia to join the European community. Yes. That will be a great trump card that will force to change the situation.
Yet at a meeting in Europe, this week, when Secretary Rice, in fact, mentioned the prospect of inviting Serbia
it's
to join the...
It's a very prudent approach.
And Foreign Minister Lavrov practically blanched on the stage.
You know what? I don't think that Russia would be very aggressive, and I'm not sure that Russia definitely will veto in the Security Council if China will abstain. So a lot depends on the big brother China.
Big brother China. There's a change. Thanks very much for the call, Dan.
Thank you for taking it.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go to, this is Andy. Andy's calling us from Germany.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question for the guests about Russia's demographic problem, how the population is basically collapsing, and if you read some things, there won't even be a Russia in X years in the future. Are they feeling that pressure at the government level, and is that impacting the relationship?
Lilia Shevtsova.
Yes, this is really a very dramatic issue. Our population still declines, and if the current trends continue, in 70 years' time, we apparently will have approximately 100 million people, which is not going to be enough in order to keep Russia's federation in the current geographical format. So the major problem is apparently somehow to solve the problem. Current government understands the problem, but, you know, with all reforms put on the back burner, I don't think that, you know, Putin's and his team that are leaving the scene have any kind of adequate solution to the demographic problem.
Thank you very much, Andy. Just follow up on that. Putin and his team leaving the scene. Are Putin and his team really leaving the scene, or is he going to be the power behind the throne of whichever person becomes the next president of Russia.
Now, you have definitely an existential question for us Russians. Well, it's totally unthinkable that Putin will leave the scene at least 1 year after he is gone, because there will be a lot of continuity of the policy, continuity of the regime, and of course his folks, his team, will be in the Kremlin. So for him, apparently, there will be a possibility to play the role of the Russian Deng Xiaoping, but only for a very brief period of time, because Russia does not understand duality of power. Mm-hmm. And so the Tsar who is elected will be the Tsar already beyond year 2009. So the new leader, the new regime will be installed pretty soon.
But isn't that person likely to be one of Putin's acolytes? Everybody's talking about the defense minister, Ivanov.
Well, apparently there are several candidates, and Ivanov, the former defense minister, is one of the most important and influential presidential hopefuls. But at the same time, President Putin, wishing not to be lame duck at the decline of his tenure, can get out a joker out of his sleeve or pocket any moment.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to line six. And line six is Bob. Bob calling us from Oklahoma.
Yes, interesting discussion. Speaking of duality, most of the people in the world are trying to move away from that concept. And that brings me to the point that I'm trying to make, is that what was said earlier about these two leaders being lame ducks and their influence, whether or not they have any or not. My goodness, at this point in time, with global warming and human rights at stake all over the world, these two leaders should step up to the plate and deal with these things that they could have some influence on, instead of continuing to militarize. You know, that's my point.
Mm, are they
to that, please?
When they get to Kennebunkport in July, are they going to be talking about the issues that we've been talking about and the sniping that's been going on from both sides, Lilia Shevtsova? Are they going to get to these broader issues that Bob is asking about?
Hardly. It seems to me Daryl was right. They would be speaking about security issues, and they will be trying to tone down the general criticism, because hardly both leaders would like to leave the political scene having such a complicated legacy, having, you know, the elements of the Cold Peace in the relationship between Russia and America.
Can I just make a follow-up comment?
Go ahead, please.
Yes, I think that's just rubbish. I think if we want to grind the world into extinction in terms of the human race and habitat for other species, they'll do that. Otherwise, they'll step up to the plate and deal with the issues that most of the people in the world want them to deal with.
Bob, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yep. Bye-bye. Here's an email from Marianne in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. I would like to know your opinion on the Nashi movement members trying to physically attack Estonia's ambassador to Russia in Moscow, a violation of international law. I'm Estonian, was extremely angry and scared of the riots a few weeks ago. If you watch the local Estonian news, the riots and what happened afterwards was shocking. Many Russians in Estonia are good. However, the young disenfranchised are angry, and at one point some Russians stopped their cars downtown, blocking traffic, lying that their cars were broken down. Suddenly all the cars were broken. As you go, Daryl Kimball, as you look at this confrontation, and I guess that's not too strong a word, between Estonia and Russia, clearly that's a problem that's not going away anytime soon.
Well, that's correct. And the United States and Russia have a number of issues upon which they differ. And I think that we have to take a look at the recent news headlines and understand what is leading to this harsher rhetoric. There have always been issues about democratization and what happens to the former Soviet republics. Those are very important. But I think what President Bush and the next president has to focus on is how can they resolve the residual Cold War weapons issues that are really heating this up. And just to take a cue from our caller a couple of minutes ago from Oklahoma, there are some things that they can do that are quite bold. You know, right now the United States and Russia have approximately 4,000 to 5,000 strategic nuclear missiles aimed at one another, many of which are on high alert. For me, 20 years after the Cold War or so, I mean, this is not a situation that makes too much sense. We're not enemies. We're not allies. we should both be moving down with these arsenals. They have the opportunity to do that in a much more serious and permanent fashion. So this is one of the key things that ought to be on the agenda, because that can, I think, lead to progress in many of these other difficult areas. And you certainly don't want to have these residual problems left over from the Cold War getting in the way of solving these other important issues like Estonia, democratization, and others.
Do Presidents Bush and Putin, though, have time to incorporate broad global aims, if you will, what's remaining in their tenures?
They do both have some time, especially President Bush, and they can also set the tone and the course for their successors. They may not be able to complete certain agreements, but they can begin the process.
Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association and Lilia Shevtsova, a senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center, are with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Les. Les on the line with us from California.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have some disagreements with both of the people, but I also have a question. The first, I have lived a fair amount of time in both the Soviet Union and Russia, families there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to point out that the dispute between Russia and the United States really occurred under the Clinton administration. And I can tell you when I was there that the dismay at the way the Clinton administration treated Russia was profound, because 15 years ago there was a lot of respect for the United States, there was a lot of love for the United States. That has all gone. Most of that had to do with the Clinton administration pushing policies to privatize what was happening in Russia and the Soviet Union, and pushing policies which basically aided actually what some people in Russia today call genocide of the Clinton administration. So I can tell you there was more feeling of positiveness toward the Bush than the Clinton administration. So that's one point I want to bring up.
When you talked about the genocide of the Clinton administration, you're talking about the war in Kosovo?
No, I'm talking about the dismantlement of the educational system, the dismantlement of the healthcare system, the dismantlement of the infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
Which was because of the privatization that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
This had to do with loans for shares for loans.
Okay.
Process that really dismantled much of what kept that society together. The reason why Putin has a very, very high popularity rating today is because he has reestablished many of these things, many of the things about the infrastructure. I go to Siberia every year, and I'm surprised. 6 years ago, there was a lot of money in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but that has flowed out. People are seeing the infrastructure actually being rebuilt, mm-hmm. under Putin, and that's why his popularity rating is so high. Most of the presidents, like Gorbachev, when they left the office, had a very low popularity rating.
And we're running out of time here, Les.
I would argue that Putin will be the power behind the throne simply because he is this person who's leaving the office with a high popularity rating, and it's very different than what happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
My question would be, what changes can the United States make? I mean, this is the important thing because I'm living here, and it seems to me the United States had made some agreements with the Soviet Union not to expand next to their borders, and they broke those agreements because they say it's no longer the Soviet Union, it's Russia, and they've broken a lot of agreements. It seems to me we could, in fact, make and have made arrangements to have a closer relationship with Russia if we, as the United States, would do certain things, certainly not putting missiles in Eastern Europe.
And we're going to have to stop you there if we're going to get a response at all, Bob. Les, I'm sorry, but Lilia Shevtsova.
That was a very interesting comment. Thank you, Les. Firstly, I would agree with you. Well, the chill started already during the Clinton-Yeltsin's tenure. In fact, Clinton and Yeltsin's period has ended with a cooling of the relationship, but not with such profound deterioration. And I would say, living in Russia through the Yeltsin's and Putin's era, I would say that we at the moment, by the way, complaining about the American role, we overestimated the American input. And American driver or American variable during the Yeltsin's transformation, this is second. And thirdly, I am not in a position, of course, to advise the American administration, but on the part of the Russian liberal minority or ghetto, tiny, tiny liberal ghetto minority, I would say that what we would anticipate from the U.S. administration. Firstly, understanding of what's happening in Russia. Secondly, maybe a humble approach and do no harm policy. Thirdly, engagement, engagement, engagement on all fronts. And fourthly, practice what you preach.
Les, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Lilia Shevtsova, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Lilia Shevtsova, senior associate at the Moscow Carnegie Center, also with us here in Studio 3A today. Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association. Appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
Coming up, and you'll want to stay awake for this, sleep and why we never seem to get enough. Not only that, but we make excuses for not getting more rest. An expert on sleep joins us next. Tell us your excuses. Why don't you get enough sleep at night? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.